The Book Nook on WISO is presented by the Greene County Public Library, with additional support from Wright Memorial Public Library, Clark County Public Library, Tipp City Public Library, Dayton Metro Library, and Washington Centerville Public Library.
Hello, welcome to the Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McCunis. It's my pleasure to welcome to the studio today Steve Moriarty. He's got a new book out. It's called Mia Zapata and the Gits, a story of art, rock, and revolution. It all began right here in Yellow Springs, Ohio. Welcome to the program.
I'm honored to be here.
Steve, this is quite a book, and I can tell that it took you a long time to decide to write this. Did you say it started off as a graphic novel idea originally?
It's an odd story. I was at home, I think it was 2013, and I was just getting into Facebook, and someone texted me through Facebook and said, "My name's Pat Moriarty, and I'm a cartoonist in Seattle. I've worked with the likes of Peter Bagg and Charles Bukowski and so forth and so on." And he had quite a resume, and I'd heard of him, and I'd seen his work before in Seattle and internationally. And he was sort of a – not a political cartoonist, but more of an arts cartoonist. He liked music and punk rock stuff and arts. Ironically, my father's name was Pat Moriarty. So I thought it was a joke. I said, "Is this my father returned from the grave? Because he died, you know, in 1994. He says, "No, I'm not your goddamn father. I'm a cartoonist." I'm like, "Oh." And I was planning on making a graphic novel about a band from Seattle called Mudhoney, and that band's kind of boring, so I thought I would prefer to do a graphic novel about your band, the Gits. And I thought, "Is this a joke?" And we got to talking, and turned out it wasn't, and he wanted to do a graphic novel, and I'd read them before. I'd read The Watchmen and Sandman and some of the classics, but I wasn't, to be honest, a big fan. We started working together. He started drawing. I would write stories that were circular. It would have a beginning, middle, and end, so you could have a nice little comic and then go on to the next one and put them all together and have a graphic novel. That was my impression of a graphic novel. But the stories kept coming, and I was sort of flooded with memories of Antioch College and forming the band and things we'd been through and the end of the band and all the things in between, and I just kept writing and writing and writing. It became this therapeutic catharsis, I guess, and the more I wrote, the more came up for me, and 100 pages turned into 200, turned into 300, turned into 400 that had to be edited down later for a book, and we eventually split the project into two, so there will be some sort of artistic project with his drawings and my stories, but I went ahead and finished it as a memoir, which is now 240 pages. It's not insurmountable.
And Steve, you were the drummer for the Gits, mm-hmm. and as you mentioned, it all started right here at Antioch College. In fact, it kind of started over on Dayton Street in a place that's still there called the Dayton Street Gulch. You had just come to Antioch, and you went in there to get a beer or something, and you encountered a couple women sitting there. And one of them was named Mia, and this is her story. Tell us, we have a lot of listeners out there who have never heard of the Gits.
Okay.
Who were the Gits?
Well, we took our name. Then it was our band, right? We formed a band and we needed a name, and we all happened to be Monty Python's Flying Circus fans, if anyone remembers that. Back in the day at Antioch, we all had, well, maybe 1 in 10 people had a little black and white TV that we would watch PBS and whatever we could get on the antennas. And they all gather in the rooms, and I think we would drink beer and watch TV, and it was just fun. And Monty Python's Flying Circus came on, and there's a skit in there from about 1972 where a family walks into a cocktail party. The entire skit's 30 seconds long, and he introduces himself with his family as a sniveling little rat-faced git, and his son is silly, dumb little git, and his wife is stupid, fat, ugly, boring git. And we thought the Gits was just a funny name, and so we called the band Sniveling Little Rat-Faced Gits to begin with. We actually wrote a letter to the Flying Circus people then England asking permission to use the name, and they granted it. And I wish I still had that letter, but it was completely legit. It wasn't until we moved to Seattle years later that we shortened it to the Gits. It was always Sniveling Little Rat-Faced Gits, which is long but kind of catchy.
And in the story in your book, you talk about how you were on campus. You'd come over here from Indianapolis and how this was a very musical campus. Everyone seemed to have a guitar. Everyone seemed to have an instrument. And you're walking around and you're meeting all these people. And you weren't in just one band, were you? There seemed to be bands springing up everywhere back in the day. Give us some idea when this was and what was happening.
Yeah, it was odd. It was 1985, as a matter of fact. And I just spent a year in Spain as an exchange student. And I came back and I had a soccer scholarship to play soccer for DePaul University. But then when I was in Spain, I saw these kids playing soccer with like a wad of tape way better than I could play with a ball. And just realized that the level of play here was just nowhere compared to Europe, and that I really, really couldn't be that good because these kids were that much better in Spain. In any case, I passed on the scholarship and I was working, doing landscaping in Indianapolis, and I got really bad sunburned and was just, I think I was making $4.50 an hour and thinking, well, at least I'm part of the working class. You know, I'll be out there with everybody else working hard, getting sunburned and coming home, my pickup truck, and that'll be my life. And then I thought, this is not going to be my life after a few weeks of that. And started looking for other ways to attend college, and I saw in the U.S. News and World Report the 10 top colleges in the country at the time, or liberal arts schools. I don't remember exactly what it said, but there was Antioch on page 3, and it said, like, bastion for modern liberalism. Antioch is a place where unusual, freakish students tend to go and is welcoming to gay, lesbian, LGBTL folks, all of all sorts, and it just seemed like a really welcoming, bizarre place, which is exactly what I thought didn't exist in the country. So I decided to visit. I took one look at the place, overgrown, spray paint. There was a big hammer and sickle painted on what was supposedly a fire station that they had, and I thought, this is the place for me. And so I went to the bank and took out a student loan at 10% interest and started attending. I didn't have a soccer scholarship for Antioch, so that came out of pocket. And I finished paying it off. Well, I will finish paying it off, hopefully, next year.
Whoa. My guest is Steve Moriarty, and we're talking about his book, Mia Zapata and the Gits, A Story of Art, Rock, and Revolution, on 91.3 WYSO, which is mentioned in the book. Connecting our community through news, music, and storytelling on the air and online. You're in that bar, and you meet a guy named Michael Caselli, who is on the faculty at Antioch College at this very moment. And I don't know if you really were as naive as you portray yourself in the book, but you claim that you thought that some of the Kennedy political family were going to be on campus, and Caselli was involved with this. But it turned out that it was actually a punk band from San Francisco, the Dead Kennedys, that was going to be on campus. And I can't believe you were so naive, but maybe you were. You had never really heard punk until you got here, right?
I was from Indiana. So, no, I had not heard of punk rock. They didn't have that kind of music. I remember when I saw a poster for a band called The Clash in the window of my local record store, and it was big, and it had a picture of a black and white picture of Paul Simon and the bass player smashing his bass on the stage, and I thought, wow, that band looks dangerous. And I went in to buy the record, and it happened to be my high school art teacher working in there as a second job, and he pretended he didn't know me, but he said, you want the punk rock stuff? It's behind the black curtains over there with the porno videos. And I went, what? So back then they would hide the punk with the porno section in the stores. So I went back there and bought it, and it said it was $4.99. And that record pretty much changed my life and turned me on to punk. But no, I had no idea. And when I came to Antioch after having lived in Spain. I was not completely naive. You know, I had survived on my own for over a year prior to coming to school. But it fascinated me. That's the kind of music I want to explore. I had grown up playing jazz. My mother corrected me today and said that I'd been playing drums since I was 5 years old. And I don't remember that long ago. I say 12 because that's probably my working memory. But she said I've been playing since five, and I studied jazz. My first tape that I got to play in my knockoff Sony Walkman that I got for my 11th birthday was John Coltrane, A Love Supreme. I loved bebop and hard bop and jazz music, but I couldn't find anyone to play with. And, you know, in the early 80s, that my age just wants to play hard bop. And so I started looking for other music, and then I discovered bands like really complicated bands, progressive rock bands like Genesis and Yes and Marillion and these very complicated, almost orchestral bands, rock bands. And I thought, how pretentious, how like silly. And they wear robes and they have cod pieces on. I just didn't understand. And then I saw the Clash poster, and they were wearing probably what they were on the street. And they just looked like regular guys, and they were up there really looked like they had something to say. So I went from being a jazz sophisticate to being a street punk rock fan and player. But I always considered myself a drummer and a musician, not necessarily identifying with some kind of counterculture or cultural bent. But that was my introduction to punk, and it fit my temperament. You know, I was 18. I'd just come from the Basque Country in Spain where I had to defend myself being American. That was the Reagan years. And one time I went to my school there, where I spent my senior year, and on the schoolyard wall, it said "Yankee del Instituto a casa," which means "Yankee of the high school, go home." So that was the atmosphere I was growing up in. Nor did I speak Basque or Spanish for a while. I learned eventually. So I was fairly politically aware even at that age. And I wanted to do something that had a message more than a sound. I didn't care how well someone could play. That didn't interest me, what virtuosity there was. I wanted to know what someone felt. That's why I also love the blues and other art forms that are very emotional and emotionally based. They might have a simple structure, but the message and the sound and the intention is emotional and passionate and real and sometimes political.
It's the Book Nook on WYSO. I've been joined in studio by Steve Moriarty, and we're going to be talking about Mia Zapata right after this. The Book Nook continues on WYSO. I've been joined in studio by Steve Moriarty, who hasn't been back on the campus of Antioch College in a few months, a few years, a few decades, and here he is talking about a story that began right here on the campus. Mia Zapata and the Gits, a story of art, rock, and revolution. Let's talk about Mia, because this is really her story, and you've brought her to life in this book.
Thank you. Mia was from Louisville, Kentucky. That's where she went to high school. I came from Indianapolis, Indiana. We're talking about just, you know, either side of the Ohio River. Is that the Mason-Dixon line? No. But it sure seems like the divide between the South and the North and both. We sort of grow up in similar-sized cities with similar attitudes, lots of segregation, like sort of Rust Belt / Bible Belt towns with a lot of economic disparity and racial disparity. And I think college for us was a way to escape that and to find something new. And for both of us, Ohio was like another world because it was one state away from where we grew up. We landed here. I met her because on one of my first days at school before the first day of classes, I met a couple of chaps that I would end up in the same band with. And we went for a walk down, is that Dayton Street out there or Xenia Avenue? The main drag, Nail Springs, Ohio, looking to see what was out there. And we came across a place called the Dayton Street Gulch / Saloon. I don't know what it's called now. It had swinging like cowboy doors. I was 19 or 8. No, I must have been 18. And the drinking age was 19. So I was still underage. Drinking age was 19 in that year in Ohio, and then was going up every year afterwards. Walked in, and my friends disappeared into the back, started playing pool. And then as my eyes adjusted to the light, I realized I looked at the cast of characters lined up at the bar, and there were guys in John Deere hats and bikers with their insignia on the back of their jackets, and it looked like disgraced college professors and perhaps dropped out students. It was a fairly motley crew of – it was a pretty tough bar, to be honest, it seemed to me. And I was just about to leave because I had dyed my hair pink the night before and was afraid that that was not going to – it's not going to go over too well in that bar, when a couple of women signaled me to come over and say hello. So nervous and my palms was sweating, I went over to the table and said, "Hi, I'm Steve. I'm a new student here at college." They said, "Oh, yeah, that's – hi, I'm Mia, and this is my friend Jesse, and we're art students. And it's really pleased to meet you." Oh, and I finally felt welcome. They said, "Pull up a chair." Okay, I did. They said, "Do you like tequila?" And I was like, "Sure." I'd never had tequila before. So they signaled to the bartender, who brought over tequila and beer for us. And they taught me to drink tequila. And Mia asked me what I did. And I said, "Well, you know, I'm studying – I think I'm going to study journalism. But, you know, I also like music. I'm a drummer, but I don't know if they really have much of a music program here. I heard about this professor named Ronsheim, who's really cool, but there's no way to study instrumental music, and kind of bummed about that, but there's plenty of other things to do." And Mia said, "What do you mean you're not an artist?" And I said, "Well, I'm not an artist. I'm a drummer." She goes, "Well, a drummer is an artist." And I just never heard a musician or a drummer or me referred to as an artist. And I really thought, wow, that really moved me and made me think, well, maybe what I do is legitimate, and maybe I have been playing drums since I'm 5, and maybe it is unusual that I like jazz and that I can play as well as I do. Maybe I'll try playing music here and find some folks and put the band together. In the same conversation, they said that there was going to be a concert coming up, and they were rebuilding the Antioch Theater in order to hold this first concert, and they said that some members of the Kennedys were coming, and I thought, wow, this place is really – I mean, look at the main building. It's beautiful. It must be famous. They've got the Kennedy family coming to speak. Which one was it? Was it like this John? Was the son of John F. Kennedy or Bobby or Jackie O? Would she wear those hats? You know, I seriously thought that. And then a fellow named Michael Caselli, otherwise known as Professor Caselli, came over and asked for volunteers to help work on this show, building the stage and preparing it for this for people to come in and witness it. I volunteered, of course, because, gosh, maybe I'd get access. I could write a story about that. You know, my journalism career could take off. I could be in the New York Times. Wow, what an opportunity. This place is amazing. So I showed up that night. It was kind of a clandestine opportunity, a clandestine operation, and involving bolt cutters and brooms and shovels and crowbars. And I thought, what the heck's going on? And it's after dark, November. They opened the place up and started sweeping it out. And soon I realized that, no, there was not a member of the Kennedy family coming, but a band from San Francisco called the Dead Kennedys, who were being investigated by the FBI at the time, who had put out 2 or 3 albums, and they were on tour with their album called Frankenchrist that featured a painting of H.R. Giger on the cover, which had been recalled, and the singer charged with what was it, a crime?
Disseminating pornography.
Disseminating pornography to children or something like that. Because of the nature of the Geiger painting on the cover.
That was Jello Biafra.
Jello Biafra, right? But no, this was a punk rock concert that they were having. It wasn't a speech. And that was my introduction, not to punk as a music, but to live punk. And I swear, every punk rocker, librarian, hippie, record store person, music enthusiast, alternative culture human being in this area of Ohio and probably beyond showed up at that show. Because I don't think bands like that made it through here very often. And I was just – my jaw was open the whole time. They were so tight and fast and intensity of the music and the lyrics, just the way they played, the way they weren't – they didn't have a rock and roll attitude. They didn't spread their legs and look cool, and they didn't use cucumbers down their pants to accentuate certain non-musical elements. And they just surprised me. They blew me away. People were stage diving and pogoing and slam dancing. This is 1985, so I hadn't seen this before. Just my jaw dropped. After that, I thought, this is what I want to do. I want to play like that guy on drums. I want to be in a band like this. I don't care what it takes. This is what I'm going to do. Next day, I drove to Indianapolis and picked up my drums and came back.
If you're just tuning in, you're listening to Book Nook. My guest in studio is Steve Moriarty. He was the drummer for the Gits, and he's written about that experience in his book, Mia Zapata and the Gits, A Story of Art, Rock, and Revolution. There's so much here, and we obviously could do this interview for several hours, but we need to kind of squeeze things together here and describe how you went from being in this band here in Yellow Springs to Seattle and what the scene was like out there. And we need to talk about Mia and about her songwriting and about her ability, her voice, and just what she was like, because you really tell us all about her personality, about her sense of humor, about her genius.
Yeah, and that was really the point of the book, to be honest, because as your listeners may or may not know, Mia was raped and murdered by a stranger in 1993, just at the peak of our career, just on the cusp of our signing a record deal with probably Atlantic Records. There was no evidence. We did not find the murderer. We hired a private investigator, the band, to try to find out who did it. And we did solve it 10 years later, and he's in prison and recently died of COVID. So that as the preface. I wanted to write the book that had nothing to do with that. If you go to Wikipedia now, that's the first thing and the last thing and pretty much all you will read about. You won't read about what an incredible talent she was, her insights into music and life and being a person, the way just her humanity, her creativity, the fact that she was a brilliant painter and writer in other ways and poet. She was the kind of person that you could be in a room with 100 people, and they would all have something to say to you. But if you were with Mia, you would be the only person in the room. She would pay attention to you like that. She was just a sincere, demure, kind, shy, and gentle person. But then when she got on stage with the Gits, this other side came out, and it was raw and intense. And I would have to say, blew Jello Biafra off the stage if we were to play back to back. Her phrasing was like a jazz musician or a great blues musician. She loved Billie Holiday and Bessie Smith, Ma Rainey, Patti Smith, Frank Sinatra. She loved very musical singers who expressed themselves in ways that were unique and improvisatory, and she just had a special ability. She had a gift, an absolute gift, for communicating through music. And on stage, she was a joy to play with. She was the only musician that has ever helped me carry my drums in and out of gigs. That's a notable thing if you've been in bands. But she was a kind, gentle, creative, and loving person. Kind of the opposite of what you'd expect from someone who's a, quote, rock star. Maybe it's better that we did not end up with huge success. If you look at we moved to Seattle after two of us graduated. I graduated with a degree in social work. Matt Dresner, our bass player, graduated with a degree in visual arts. Andy and Mia both studied music and art, and I don't know that they took a degree home, but they may have later. We all moved together in 1989 to Seattle to start the band there because, as people ask, why Seattle? At the time, we said, well, it's as far away as you can get from Yellow Springs because we've been here for 4 years and we were ready to go. Mm-hmm. We got there and there was this rock scene starting to unfold, which we didn't know about, and we didn't move there for that reason. There were bands like Nirvana and Soundgarden and Pearl Jam, I guess, were the notable ones, and others. If I look back now at the singers from those bands, 8 out of 10 are dead, have died of drugs and so forth. Well, that was not Mia. Mia was not part of that scene, and we were a little bit different because we based our music, I think, on – people ask what our musical influence was, and I usually say, well, each other and our musical influences or not. But we were learning to play together and writing songs in Ohio – in Yellow Springs, in a proverbial vacuum, was an advantage because we weren't influenced by trends and by what other people were doing. We couldn't get MTV. They didn't have cable here yet. When we moved to Seattle, we were a fully developed band. We had recorded a 17-song, quote, demo at a place called The Music Source, I think it was called. It was on next to the Dayton Street Gulch on whatever that street is over there in Yellow Springs. That had a 24-track recording studio right here in our midst.
It sounds like Chris Hertzler's place.
That was Chris Hertzler. I forgot his name. Thanks.
Yeah. Chris Hertzler used to produce this program.
Oh, is he still around?
He's still around. He's a good man.
I'd love to meet him and give him a copy. I don't even think he got a copy.
I'll tell him.
The record that we made, the demo we made there became a record and became our top-selling record. And it was recorded live to 2 tracks just because we couldn't afford any more than that. Then we made the whole thing for $300.
Wow.
It's still selling. It's called Kings and Queens, the album. And I've lost my train of thought again. I think you might have to help me get back to it.
Oh, you're fine. You're listening to the Book Nook on WYSO. My guest is Steve Moriarty. We're talking about how Mia Zapata and the Gits ended up in Seattle, in that scene out there in Seattle. And we're going to continue my conversation with Steve right after this. You're listening to the Book Nook on WYSO. I've been joined in studio by Steve Moriarty, who has returned to Yellow Springs after a long hiatus, and he's here to talk to us about his new book, Mia Zapata and the Gits, A Story of Art, Rock, and Revolution. Very well received. You might have heard about it on National Public Radio. It's been getting a lot of attention, and we were at the point where the band had moved to Seattle, and you were saying how you guys just had this tight show. In the book, you talk about how you could get up there and you could be set up on stage in 10 minutes. You could do 14 songs in 40 minutes with hardly any breaks between the songs, and then you'd be off the stage in 10 minutes. I mean, you guys were brutal.
We were practiced. We rehearsed. And Andy and Matt, bass and guitarist, had grown up going to shows at CBGB's in New York City because they were both from New York. And there were Saturday matinee shows there, so they'd seen hardcore bands. And then we later played CBGB's, and they would have 5 and 6 bands a night, right after the other. So you had to get on and off the stage in 5 or 10 minutes, or they would throw you off the stage. It was like the Gong Show with a hook. They'd come out and pull you off. But that in mind, we didn't mess around, and most of the shows that we played had 3 and 4 bands on it. We started out opening the shows for bands like The Accused, a hardcore band, and a band called Built to Spill, and Doug Marsh is the guy. Marsh is the guy's name.
Yeah, Built to Spill. Uh-huh.
Built to Spill.
Yeah.
But we were having trouble finding gigs, and we got a call from a record label called Sub Pop, and they asked if one of the members of a band called Nirvana had seen us and really liked us and wanted us to open a show for them. So I think our third show in Seattle was opening for Nirvana at the University of Washington Hub Ballroom, and I think that was to that point the largest crowd we'd ever played to. And we got on and off stage in like fashion. We got off so fast that they didn't know what to do afterwards. Before Nirvana went on, they had this big dead space because we were off. We thought we were supposed to get off quickly.
And all four bands on that bill ended up being banned in perpetuity from the University of Washington.
Yeah, yeah, it's true. We didn't do that much. But
it's because Nirvana went all Who on it, right?
They didn't really – I didn't think it was that bad. I mean, they were chasing each other around, and I remember there was an ice fight, and they did try to do that college football thing where you throw the tub of ice over the other guy, and like Kurt was chasing Chris Novoselic around the dressing room, and they were throwing erasers at one another, and then, oh, yeah, Chris picked up the bus tub that was empty of – sodas and beer, but it's still full of ice water, and tried to throw it on Kurt and miss Kurt and hit some poor journalist. And pretty soon their management came and shooed them off to do an interview, and we were left there. And then it was like, all right, you're on in 5 minutes. We were on in 3 minutes and ready to go. And the place lit up because we played faster, and I think they were a little more exciting for people. And so they were stage diving to the point that the monitors fell off the front of the stage, and they had to stop the crowd and start us over again. And to this day, when I go to Seattle, which is 2 or 3 times a year, I live in Oakland, California now, people will stop me on the street and say, I was at that show. Uh-huh. I was at that show. Yeah. And it feels good. It feels good that we pulled it up, that we impressed people to that point that is remembered 30 years later.
You guys worked really hard, but you weren't getting the attention that these other bands were getting. You weren't getting the gigs. You were willing to play anywhere. But you did end up doing a lot of touring. You guys even toured Europe.
Yeah. I was working at a cafe and picked up the Seattle Weekly and had a story in there about how Nirvana, Mudhoney, and a band called Tad had all gone to Europe and had come back during the fall of the Berlin Wall. And I was like, wow, they did what? They did what? They got to do what? And I was incensed that they had been there because the only quote they had about it was, wow, their beer was really strong there in Germany and Berlin. It was cool. And I was like, you're witnessing one of the most consequential historical events of the century, and all you can think about is how strong the beer is. I'm going to Europe. And so I started to try to book a tour of Europe. So we booked a tour of Europe ourselves, sending out envelopes with a 7-inch single and a letter in it and a Xerox poster to put up in their club. And somehow we pieced together about 16 or 17 shows and landed in Amsterdam a few months later and toured Europe. And I'm still in touch with the people that we met there. And we played Berlin, we played Switzerland, we played Norway, Sweden, Holland, all over Western Europe.
And they loved you over there, didn't they?
They loved it. I think that at that point you rarely saw women in bands and rarely saw women fronting bands. And if they were, there was all women bands. And it was some sort of novelty act or something at that point. And Mia, just the fact that she was such a natural and was so communicative with people and was not pretentious, she would talk to anyone that wanted to talk to her about music. And she encouraged a lot of women to step up and play that had never felt like they could or had the opportunity before. I think she'll be remembered for that more than anything. Mm-hmm. The Riot Girl movement, which is still really prevalent, which is kind of a precursor to the Me Too feminist movement, started by young people in Olympia mostly. And Mia did not subscribe to that. She actually had not heard of it. And in the back of the end of the book, she's introduced to the movement by a couple of young women who come up to her and say, "Are you a Riot Girl? And you're a Riot Girl?" But Mia's a second wave feminist. So she's like, "I know about riots, but I tell you one thing, I ain't no girl. Call me no girl." So, but of course, this sentiment was equal. And those bands began, I think, to really honor and revere Mia as an icon. Kathleen Hanna held up the book the other day at a show. She's a singer in Bikini Kill in front of 10,000 people and said, "You need to read this book." Mm-hmm. And since I write about the Riot Girl movement in the last chapter, I was honored, but really I was very relieved that she didn't take offense.
Yeah.
Because maybe I got it right.
Steve Moriarty joins us. His book is Mia Zapata and the Gits, A Story of Art, Rock, and Revolution. I was reading the book with a sense of dread because I was really concerned about getting to the end and reading about what happened to her. And I liked the way you handled the ending of the book. I think that was really beautiful. We were getting to know who what she was like and getting to bring her back to life on the pages. And she stays that way for us as readers because of the way that you decided to do this. And near the end, she had her own demon. You mentioned beer. She was having some alcohol issues. And you go on this tour of the U.S. where she cleaned up her act and she was brilliant. And you were about ready to put out your second record and you were about ready to go on another tour of Europe when the bad thing happened. And we're at this point in her life and all this stuff is happening. Like you have these great little snapshots where you're at a gas station and some guy starts talking to her and treating her like a gas station attendant. This is a great story.
I'll continue it. It's also called the David Bowie story. Mia liked to help out. Like she helped, liked to help me carry the drums. She also liked to do the windshield of the van when we'd pull over to get gas and so forth. She could check the oil. She checked the oil. She did the windshield, the side windows. And she was doing that, and a Jaguar pulled up in the pump next to us. And the guy said, excuse me, miss, in an English accent. Could you run inside and fetch me a pack of fags? And I think Mia said something to him like, what? I'm not going to go get you. Called him a homophobe and said that she didn't work there. And thank you for insinuating that she did work there. But, you know, because she was wearing like a gas station attendant jacket that she probably found in a dumpster somewhere. And Mia wore whatever on stage, what she would put on in the morning, and that didn't have a lot of clothes anyway. So she was wearing what she was wearing, and it was also really, really hot outside. And so she yelled at David Bowie,
but she didn't know who he was.
She didn't know who he was.
This is L.A.
Give him
right?
a FU. It was right. in Los Angeles, yeah. And it was and 7 o'clock in the morning.
Her brother was with you.
Yes, her brother was with us because he lived there and worked there and had a salon on Sunset Avenue. And he was really angry. He said, Damn it, Mia, you know who that was. You just blew it. He could have helped your career. And Mia was, like, very upset. So she grabbed a bunch of singles out of the van and started running, chasing David Bowie down the street with the singles in her hand, going, wait, stop. I got a present for you. And David, I can see him looking over his shoulder going, who is this lunatic chasing me down the street? And she got back in the van after that, dejected and really sad. Just went into the back of the van and went to sleep. She was so bummed. And we were laughing. It was sad but cute.
One of many stories in the book by Steve Moriarty, Mia Zapata and the Gits, A Story of Art, Rock, and Revolution.
Yeah.
And I have a listener out there who's actually in Oregon, and he listens to this program early in the morning. Mm. And I'm sure that when he hears this part, it's going to wake him right up because at one point you got a speeding ticket today when you were coming here.
I did.
And you were coming from Indianapolis, and you guys – are on the road, driving along, going to a gig, and you see this van driving along, and you write, it was a punk mandate to tease deadheads. The Grateful Dead's music was long-winded, self-indulgent, repetitive, and mind-numbingly boring. Now, my friend in Oregon is a deadhead, so I want you to address this thing about the Grateful Dead. I want you to explain to him why you think that.
This is like a Russian courtroom. I should be in a cage. Hey, it wasn't my idea, but back in the mid-'80s, late 70s, punks had to have they had to push against something, right? They had to have their counter. They were punks. And sort of the prevailing idea was that Grateful Dead's heads were the opposite of punk rockers. So they would travel around, not work. I think the gist of it was, the gist of this mindless prejudice was that punk rockers thought that deadheads were throwbacks to the 60s who would rather do drugs than make change, and that punk rock was more about living in the now and making change through whatever means necessary, even if that's in a radical, usually leftist way, where deadheads would seem to just rather take drugs and drive around in a minibus following the band on their parents credit card. That was the ideal.
And your driver reacted. He saw these deadheads and he reacted to this.
He just decided to bear down on the microbus that was, could only go about 40 miles an hour uphill, and with our 8-cylinder GMC window van, it was easy to catch up and ride 2 inches from the bumper for 10 miles and worry them a little bit. And that's what we did. And then until we got a speeding ticket for that, pulled over doing 90 miles an hour. And so I guess the deadheads had the last laugh as far as that was concerned.
Well, you explained to the police officer who was on a motorcycle, you explained to him that you were a band. And he wanted to know what kind of a band you were. And you were very fortunate to tell him what you were.
I didn't say anything, by the way. I was in the back hiding under a blanket because I thought we were going to prison or something, because the cop walked up to the window and said to our driver, whose name shall remain nameless, but you know who you are, what you got in the back? And he said, oh, just our musical gear. Oh, really? He checked the back because even then there were immigrants coming from other countries who wanted to be here that crossed the border and came up through California to work and become – you know, productive citizens, but it was illegal. So they checked the back. He saw, okay, it's full of gear. And who are these folks in the back? Oh, they're my band. Oh, you're a band. Yes, we're a band. Well, what kind of band are you? And our driver chimes up, we're a punk rock band. We're going to Portland for a show. And I just put my head down like, you don't tell a state trooper that we're a punk band. Like, it just doesn't, it's not going to understand what that is. And I said, you know, it's only 1990. He's not going to get it. So he walks back, checks, looks around, comes back out with his notepad, getting ready to write the ticket. I said, well, what kind of music? You play punk rock, huh? He goes, good. Well, because if you were a country band, I'd have to write you a ticket. But since you play punk rock, I'm going to let you go with a warning. That was just that was one of the odd things that happened. One of the lucky breaks we got. We got a lot of lucky breaks for one really, really bad one in the end.
Just one of the many stories in this book by Steve Moriarty, and one that I won't get into, but I think one of the most powerful accounts in the entire story is when you were in Ann Arbor with Mia and you spent the day in a cemetery. And this is really intense. This is really powerful. You felt such a connection with her, and we really get to know her through your reflections and your recollections of her. We feel like we are seeing her come back to life on the pages of your book, and I think that's so beautiful that you've been able to do this.
Thank you. It was my first experience with psychedelic medication. So I was doing a co-op in Ann Arbor, Michigan, and the co-op was to go with my other Antioch band, since drummers were in short supply. I was in two or three bands at a time called Big Brown House, and we had formed earlier. It's quite a good band. And our co-op was to go to Ann Arbor, Michigan and record an album. I think it was a 6-month co-op. We went up to Ann Arbor, Michigan, rented a big house, and started recording, writing the songs and recording an album. And we got jobs to hold us over. I worked landscaping at a condo complex. Ben London, who was the guitar player in the band, also Antioch student, worked making donuts all night at a Donuts Time donut store. Other guys had other sort of menial task labor jobs. None of us had trust funds, you know. It's like we were all paying by the skin of our teeth. And in any case, we made ends meet somehow and recorded this record. But Mia showed up out of the blue. It was like, hi, I came to visit. I was on my co-op and just came to visit you guys. And she was there, and I was very, very depressed at the time. I think I was away from – I don't know what it was. I struggled with depression at that age, as many people do. Now I'm a psychotherapist. I understand that a lot better than I did then. Depressed, she came around and said, I know just the thing. I've got this little bag of mushrooms, and we're going to try them, and we're going to go for a walk. What do you think about that? It was 95 degrees, and I thought, well, anything but go to work, so yes. And so I took a little bit, and she took twice as much, and we went for a walk down the main drag in Ann Arbor, which is it's a really cool little college town for University of Michigan. Came across an old cemetery and went in, and then the mushrooms kicked in, and the rest I will not give away, but the trip in the book became really cathartic and a beautiful way for me to get to know her and her to get to know me. And I just my heart opened, and I think I understood what it was to love somebody in a platonic way. It just couldn't be a romantic way because we were in a band together, and that was way more important than any of that. But I remember the grass turning into an ocean, a green ocean of waves, and Mia just thought it was hilarious and would run through the graveyard, jumping over gravestones and pinching the little cherubs that sat on top of them, pointing to the sky with little birdies on their hands. And we just had an interesting afternoon. And at the end of it, a thunderstorm brewed up. We started to head home. We looked for shelter. Shelter happened to be a semi-abandoned frat house on Frat Row. The University of Michigan was also known for an epidemic of violence and date rape at the time. And there were posters of that all over the place. And Mia decided that we should decorate the indoors, the inside of the place. We found some paint in a closet and decided to do some very aesthetically pleasing graffiti on the inside of their living room. And in the end, they came home and we ran for our lives, but not before Mia stole a bust of Beethoven that sat on the top of a grand piano that was in the main lobby. And the rest of the story I'll have to leave to the reader, but it goes on from there. And I think maybe that's actually a foreshadowing of events to come, but Beethoven was a looming presence in the next few pages of that book.
That is a very surreal story, and it's just one of all the stories that Steve has put together in this book. My guest has been Steve Moriarty. His book is Mia Zapata and the Gits, A Story of Art, Rock, and Revolution, and another way that we discover Mia and just what a kind, loving person she was in Seattle when she's working as a short-order cook in a restaurant in a pretty seedy neighborhood with a lot of sketchy characters, and just the way that she interacts with the clientele and her loving nature really comes through in this, and there's just so much in this book. And Steve, we really appreciate you taking the time to come back to Yellow Springs to talk to us about it.
It's an honor, and I'm glad to see this, that YSO has come so far in such a beautiful state-of-the-art studio.
Well, when I came to the station in 1993, we had jazz shows on weeknights. The programs were called Alternate Takes, and one of the hosts was Steve Schwerner, who is in your book, and another one was Warren Watson, who I'm guessing you might remember from Antioch, and those were the days, and it was so great to read a book where – and John Ronsheim, I remember him, and your accounts of Antioch and of Yellow Springs back in that period are really priceless to read. I wasn't here then, but to read them, it's just amazing. And Steve, thank you so much for your time.
It's been my pleasure and my honor. Thank you for having me.
You've been listening to The Book Nook on WYSO. Once again, the book is Mia Zapata and the Gits, A Story of Art, Rock, and Revolution. And let's see, it's published by FarrellHouse.com. That's their website. And for The Book Nook, thanks for listening.